But now let's have a look at a relative of augmented reality, and that's virtual reality. This is a computer-simulated version of the real world. Miracentha Lingam has been exploring the use of these simulated environments in medical treatment and rehabilitation.
This week, I'm at the University of East London, which is located in Stratford, and I've come along to the psychology department's virtual reality lab, and with me is Dr. Paul Penn, who's the lead researcher of the virtual reality research group here. Now, Paul, some interesting work you've been doing here is using things like virtual reality in order to rehabilitate brain-injured patients and stroke patients.
Yeah, that's right. We're really interested in looking at VR as a means to kind of improve the lot in terms of rehabilitation and assessment of people that have suffered a brain injury. A lot of brain injured patients, as part of their recovery, will spend a great deal of their time completely understimulated and not officially in therapy and things like that. That's really a problem for patients from a neuropsychological perspective, because the way the brain responds to injury, if you like, is determined by the environment in which you're trying to recover. So in other words, if you have a very stimulating environment, the chances of you getting better functional outcomes and better recovery from the injury will be that much better. So what we're really looking at is using VR as a means to enrich environments post-brain injury.
What aspects of brain function do you focus on with brain-injured patients?
It tends to be things like memory. So we look at how well people can remember route information, for example. We look at how well people can remember objects they see in an environment. We also look at the way people can remember to do things at some point in the future, what we call prospective memory. So that's things like remembering to close the front door after you've opened it, remembering to attend appointments at certain times. Very simple things that we take for granted, but are actually quite, they're very pervasive in everyday life, obviously. And these are the kind of problems that, because they're so intertwined with everyday life, you can't really assess properly in the lab. And that's what VR gives you. It gives you that chance to put real-world scenarios into the lab.
But a key point of the virtual environments that you create here are that they can be used simply on laptops and desktops, which must therefore make them much more accessible.
Yeah, absolutely. This is a really important part of our remit. So really one of the, if you like, fundamental criteria that we use when looking at VR is, well, will this run on just an average modest spec PC? What we tend to do now is what we call a Windows on world kind of system, basically, where the virtual world just appears on a computer screen. So it probably looks like a computer game, like you or I would play on a PC game or a PlayStation 3 game. But obviously the difference is that our environments are really, they have a purpose other than entertainment.
So now we've got a laptop set up in front of us, and it's got a particular virtual environment on it, which is a virtual bungalow.
So what you can basically see here is a simple sort of four-room bungalow with a hall, and the patient's task here is essentially to actually help the person who owns this virtual bungalow move to a larger bungalow. The person's task is to go through these rooms. So first of all, we've got the hall followed by the lounge, and then allocate furniture to these new rooms. So they're engaged, they're searching around the existing bungalow and they're looking for items of furniture that, for example, belong in the hall. While they're doing this, what we actually have is a series of three memory tasks. So you can think about the removal task as a kind of distraction task, essentially, because that's the way memory works in the real world. It would be very easy if all we ever had to remember is just what we had to remember, but the problem is we have all these distractions around us all the time, and it's how well we can filter out those distractions and actually, you know, get to the crux of the matter. And that's really what this environment is assessing. We're giving them the removal task as the distraction task. What we're actually looking for is how well they can remember to do three different things. Now, you might remember that I told you that remembering to do things at some point in the future is what we call prospective memory in psychology. Broadly speaking, there are three types of prospective memory. First of all, you have what we call event-based prospective memory, which is kind of memory that's precipitated by seeing something in the environment generally. So in the example of the virtual bungalow we have here, when the participant is strolling around the house, they have to look for glass items. Now, when they see a glass item, they have to remember to put a fragile notice on it, for the very simple reason we don't want the, you know, the removal men being manhandling it and breaking it. The second type of prospective memory is what we call activity-based. This kind of thing occurs when you see something in the environment that itself serves as a cue for the memory. So, for example, if you turn an oven off, on, rather, that's also your cue to turn the oven off again, because you performed an action which should then prompt another memory to perform the reverse of that action. The task we have in the virtual bungalow here is that they have to remember to close the kitchen door after they've opened it, simply because we've got a cat, a virtual cat, if you like, in there, and the cat escapes if they don't. The third type of prospective memory is what we call time-based. This is the category of memory whereby you have to remember to do something at a certain time.
Say if somebody's got a meeting or an appointment, they need to remember to do that.
Yeah, exactly. Or remembering to tune into a radio show, for example. The idea here is the person opens the front door every 5 minutes to let the removal men in.
Having these three tasks in action then when someone's in this environment, what are you specifically looking for?
The extent to which people have actually recalled or remembered to perform the task. So how many times out of a possible three have they remembered to open the front door for the removal men? How many of the, I think it's about eight items that are fragile, have they remembered to put the fragile notices on? And by looking at that kind of data, that gives us an idea of their kind of memory profile. And from that, you can kind of extrapolate what kind of problems they might have in everyday functioning.
Look for items and furniture to be moved into the hall.
Okay, so I'm just having a go on this now, and I'm walking through the hall, and it's reasonably easy to move around. So I'm just using the cursor, the arrow keys on a keyboard to move around, and then just mouse buttons in order to open doors and pick items. So I guess that's quite crucial, making it quite easy to use.
Yeah, the interface is really important, obviously, because what we're looking at here is potentially using this environment of people that may not just have memory problems, they may also have problems with perhaps their physical mobility and their dexterity.
So now, having actually tried this environment out on various stroke patients or brain injured patients, what have you found to be the improvement?
What we tend to find with this task, we've used it on stroke patients, for example. As you would expect, really, they're impaired in all three types of memory. They're particularly usually impaired on the time-based task. The time-based task tends to involve what we call self-initiated retrieval, in terms of there are no prompts in the environment. You have to remember to provide your own prompt, which is to look at the clock. And we find that people that have had a stroke can often suffer with this kind of behaviour. It's very, very difficult for them to self-initiate.
So what can you then do with this information to improve their condition or improve their memory?
So what this kind of information can do is allow the sort of rehabilitation professional to actually orientate the rehabilitation very precisely to address the problems that person has. So, for example, if they just have a problem with time-based retrieval, there's technology you can use, like personal organisers, maybe iPods, to actually provide prompts at certain points in the day for critical activities. What you can do, having interacted with this environment, is get an indication of the kind of prompts that someone will need to offset their memory problems.
That was Dr. Paul Penn from the University of East London taking Mira Senthilingam on a virtual experience to show how simulated versions of real environments can be used to monitor and rehabilitate patients that have suffered strokes or brain injuries.
Lifting the lab coat on the world's best science, the Naked Scientists.